Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with a great episode tonight. We're going to be digging into a clinical topic, which we haven't done in a while, and I know that that's something that people look forward to from time to time, so we're going to jump in with that here in a little bit. Before we can get into the clinical topics, we have to get into the other side of our podcast co-hosting duo, and that means bringing in Sam Bradley from the Not Enough Rain part of Colorado.
Well, it's not just me, and Jamie, it seems like at the moment you're getting a dose, a big dose of it, and Joe's had a dose of it out there in Memphis, and Kyle and I are wondering why we keep getting these heavy thunderstorm warnings and no rain. So Kyle, you want to explain yourself?
Yes, it's all Kyle's fault.
Yeah, we're going to give Kyle a complex if we keep blaming him for the weather. So let's stop and just acknowledge that he reports on the weather. He doesn't cause the weather.
Oh, he indeed. Knows that.
Yes, I love coming on a disaster podcast. Hello, everyone. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson here, coming to you from Grand Junction, Colorado this week on the far western side of the state along I-70. Actually spent some time with Grand Junction Regional Dispatch Center and the National Weather Service office here today, just doing some continuing education. So that's been a lot of fun doing some exploring. But back to the weather things now, Sam. Like you say, with those thunderstorms, a lot of times, especially on the eastern slopes, so like Denver, I-25 corridor into the east, you'll get those thunderstorms that kind of start over you, and then as they move east, start producing either very strong winds, so 58 miles an hour or greater, or 1-inch hail or larger. That's the criteria for those severe thunderstorm warnings that you're receiving. But as has been the case, we have a very, very dry air mass in place over the western part of the United States. And so any precipitation that falls out of those thunderstorms often never reaches the ground. It evaporates before it gets to us. So you may get some of the wind, but you're not getting, unfortunately, any of the rain. And that has been the story. Alaska and the western United States, new wildfire starts daily. I think we received 5 spot weather forecast requests just for new wildfire starts in western Colorado in the couple hours I was at the weather service this afternoon here in Grand Junction. On the other side of things, the James and Missouri rivers still at or above flood stage from South Dakota through eastern Nebraska, as well as other localized flooding that might go on. We actually had some burn scar flooding that we were dealing with from the Lake Christine burn scar in my backyard just a few weeks ago. So that was a entertaining evening in dispatch. But looking ahead, excessive heat continues for the Southwest and the Pacific Northwest. But that's a look at things here domestically, guys. Any questions on that side of things?
I think things are good, but Joe had a question if you had any information on what's going on down in South America with the Amazon wildfires. It's pretty concerning.
Yeah, it is extremely concerning, and unfortunately something that has not gotten nearly the press that many of us who pay attention to these natural phenomena would hope that it would. And there's lots of different stories coming out on this, and it's hard to, of course, find some of those definitive authoritative sources. But while there are still, fires that may occur there naturally, there are some reports coming out that a few of these may actually be intentional. So, possibly lightning strikes and things like that, but with some of the kind of background conditions that they're experiencing down there, with the weather, that's directly influencing the growth and the spread of those wildfires the same way they would here up in the U.S. So, again, lots of factors coming together, but, of course, the cause still yet to be determined, but it would be truly tragic if it was a human start.
Very sad. So what is it that's over the top of Jamie right now that he just got?
Well, Jamie is rocking and rolling out there on the East Coast, and I'll tell you, If you guys are getting it, I'm not, or vice versa. But like I said, share the rain a little bit. Panning out to the east a little bit there, Sam. Looking like there's a good little line of thunderstorms that's actually moving over Jamie and his spot up there. Just taking a quick look at the radar here, it's actually pretty localized for where Jamie's at, and prompting a few severe thunderstorm warnings and even special marine warnings for the those intercoastal waterways and things out there, and producing lots of damaging wind reports. Just trying to look at some of the observations that are coming in here that people are reporting, even wind damage in spots with some damage to lawn furniture and things from those unsecured objects being blown around outdoors. But once that moves through, Jamie, you should be free and clear for the night.
Yeah, I think so. This is the typical, you know, August thunderstorms that crop up due to the hot, humid weather. And I think they just, you know, dump over. And as soon as the clouds reach critical mass, they dump out some of the moisture and clear themselves out.
Well, hopefully you'll stay with us throughout the podcast here and lightning won't strike. So, changing the subject here, one of the things I am most intrigued with is the whole active shooter thing that just keeps, despite the best efforts to, sorry, I got dogs playing down here, despite our best efforts to prevent these kind of things, they just keep happening and more and more and more. So on a later podcast, we can talk about the psychology of these people and why they do what they do. But I started thinking about the wounds. I actually was watching a show the other day where a father-in-law wanted to take out his son-in-law and shot him point blank in the back of the head, right where his, you would think his brainstem would be, but somehow he ended up surviving that. I don't think it went in far enough. So, you know, some of these things are amazing in terms of there's just so many factors involved in ballistic injuries that we won't get into because we'd have everybody drooling probably. But, you know, it's an energy transfer thing. We've got projectile velocity, the entrance profile, the caliber, the design of the projectile, the distance traveled, all of those kinds of things. And clinically, it's the biologic characteristics of the tissue and mechanisms of tissue disruption and just a whole bunch of things. And of course, the type of ammunition that's involved is another thing. So we're going to put Joe on the spot here and see if we can answer some of these questions, because I don't know how much anybody knows about that. I'm certainly not an expert. So, Joe, in your ER experience, what types of things have you seen?
Certainly the total gamut of, you know, small caliber weapons that people accidentally shoot themselves in the, you know, big toe with, to large caliber multiple shot drive-by shootings and you know, gang hits and all kinds of stuff along those lines. And, you know, we've done a fair amount of work in Paragon with some of the military research folks looking at ballistics in particular related to, you know, the interaction of and the effect of various ballistic qualities on the human body. And, you know, there's a lot of factors that play into that. And it's actually quite surprising how I'm trying to think of the right word, as sort of how modifiable, if that's a word, and sort of customizable you can make a bullet to do things that you want it to do. So it's been a pretty fascinating project on several levels.
I can well imagine. And then, of course, you have active shooter scenarios where you take this information and you actually put it into practice, which is an awesome thing. I assume it's a much worse case scenario when you have an entrance wound without an exit wound. So I assume correctly the only way of figuring out what's going on is through an X-ray?
Well, so let's break that down a little bit. I don't know that in the big picture that statement would hold up. There's a lot of factors that play into whether or not you end up with an exit wound or not. In general, if you shoot it across the body rather than, straight through the body, it's obviously more tissue to, travel through and more likely to bump into something and all that sort of thing. I think if you look at it on a real ballistics sort of level, the fact that there's not an exit wound basically says that the entire energy of the bullet was transferred to the person that was shot, and that, that level of force obviously can potentially do more damage. But, there's many things related to that, including the caliber of the bullet, the speed of the bullet, the direction of travel, all kinds of other factors play into that.
Can you, on that note, can you explain cavitation and what it is and what it does to the body and what kind of permanent injury someone may have?
When they hit a human body or any, change in density from the air that they're being shot through, that results in a transfer of energy. Most bullets, when they strike tissue, the bullet begins to deform a little bit. The tissue obviously deforms a lot because it's much more pliable. But then the bullet begins to tumble along its path of trajectory, and that tumbling makes the relative size of the bullet larger. So, for example, if you had a long, skinny bullet that was designed that way so that it would fly through the air with the least amount of air resistance and to maintain its velocity and all that sort of stuff. And then that bullet struck tissue and turned sideways. Then, it's, as opposed to being a quarter inch across, now it's an inch across. And so that tumbling aspect has results in a massive pressure wave flowing out from that that bullet. And that pressure wave pushes the tissues apart. So if you interact with very soft and pliable tissues like, lung or in the GI tract, et cetera, then it literally blows a larger hole. So cavitation is really about how big a cavity is formed inside the tissue. And that is a result of many factors related to the bullet, from speed to weight to tumbling to design of the bullet, et cetera.
I would assume that bullets that cause fragmentation are a bigger problem. I can imagine they certainly would be in terms of cleaning them up surgically.
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate statement at kind of all levels. I think if you look at sort of standard ball type bullets, and by that I mean, a solid piece of lead that's pointy on one end and, sort of flat on the other end, those bullets tend to deform, and obviously they tumble, and it's not that they don't sometimes come apart, but they may well stay in a single piece. And then there are other bullets that are designed very differently that actually have a design like a number of flechettes, literally little tiny blade shaped pieces of bullet that are all secured together into the shape of the bullet. And when that bullet strikes tissue, those flechettes are all designed to open up much like a mushroom does and either, fly away separately or With some of these bullets, they're actually designed to sort of fold back to at about 90 degrees to the axis of the bullet. And of course, then the bullet is spinning at the same time. And so you have these metal blades literally that are sticking out on the side of the bullet while it spins its way through tissue. And the damage from those type rounds is much worse than, you know, a more typical ball type or jacketed bullet.
Wow. So, Jamie, thoughts or questions so far?
Well, I was just thinking about the many ways that, you know, we there are many types of things we encounter. And I'm curious, you know, if we kind of backtrack and talk a little bit about the if we backtrack and talk a little bit about the initial assessment of a gunshot wound for that provider on the street, you know, for coming upon that gunshot patient, what are some of the initial things that Joe would want us to be looking for as we approach and begin our assessment?
Well, that's a great question, Jamie. You know, I mean, I think much of that is fairly quote-unquote standard knowledge to those of us, you know, at all levels of EMS and emergency medicine in general. You know, I think some of the important caveats, though, are to appreciate that the hole that the entrance wound, if you will, point of entry of a, you know, a ball-type high-velocity rifle bullet may look very much or identical to the hole made by a lower velocity but more fragmentary type bullet. And so I think part of it is to sort of be careful not to put too much weight into the hole that you see. The damage underneath can vary dramatically. And you know, it's easy to say, well, it only looks like a 22 or a 38. But, you know, looking back at some of the ballistic research that we've done, especially related to the ammunition that air marshals are interested in carrying, you know, that they tend to use a smaller, lower velocity round with a bullet that has very special characteristics to it in regards to its ability to transfer lots of energy and to do a lot of damage, and ideally to transfer all of that energy into the target. You know, the idea there, of course, is that an air marshal would want a terrorist, I assume, to, you know, go down quickly, be immobilized very quickly, but would also not want that bullet to potentially exit the body of the terrorist and injure someone else or go out through the side of an airplane and cause a catastrophic, you know, hull failure on an airplane. So, you know, those bullets have a fairly unique design to them so that they do that. And the initial hole that bullet may make may look very much like the hole that, you know, a more standard bullet might look like.
Yeah, it might be better in a person than in the aircraft to defeat the purpose. Kyle, any thoughts or questions from you?
Well, I was just thinking about this too. I know we talk about it from the responder perspective and a little bit on the clinical side, but I think it's also important to note that when folks call 911, that many dispatch centers nowadays are using the medical priority dispatch system, and so that when you do call, you know, when you might be freaking out, and the focus may be on the patient and you know the trauma that has just occurred, but just know that when you reach out to us, our first priority becomes the caller's safety. Yes, we want to take care of that person, but there's also going to be scene safety questions involved, and there, you know, may seem like it's going a little bit slower, but it's all designed to get the best information for our responders. So if you are calling in and requesting, you know, 911 and assistance, saying send the ambulance now, it doesn't quite work that way. There's a protocol that we go through, and it's proven itself time and time again to have a positive outcome. We can give bleeding control instructions and a lot more as well.
Really good point, Kyle. And it always helps to have, you know, an opinion from the dispatch side, because we sometimes forget about that. But speaking of the pathophysiology, common issues, of course, are bleeding, oxygenation, amputation, bone fractures, and so forth. So, Joe, I'd like to kind of quickly skim through some of the parts of the body. Would I assume correctly that the chest, the issues with that, of course, would be, you know, heart, lung, and major vessels?
Absolutely. So, you know, lots of important structures all in pretty close proximity there. So, yeah, the chest has got lots of bad stuff to injure.
And easily injure. What about the abdomen? What do you typically see there? I mean, you know, you hear about people losing a few feet of intestines, which certainly isn't the worst case scenario. But, you know, we've got kidneys in the back and liver and so forth. What do you think about that?
Well, there's no question. There's, you know, also a lot of really important stuff in the abdomen, but I think the you know, the vasculature tends to be a little bit more widely spaced, and you know, a gunshot wound that affects the bowel in some sort of way will definitely bleed, but won't bleed like you know, a nick of your pulmonary artery or your aorta or something. So, you know, if you're lucky enough to miss really major organs and vasculature, then abdominal wounds tend to be more amenable to treatment and perhaps a little bit more easy to recover from than, you know, those that affect major vasculature or a large section of the lung or obviously the heart, et cetera.
You know, I want to bring up something that actually happened some years ago. Sorry about the dogs. We had a situation with our fire department where a guy got shot in the leg, and they treated it. Paramedics that were there kind of treated it just as a flesh wound, if you will. Well, then later the guy starts complaining of abdominal pain, and one of my BLS firefighters said, there's more going on here than just a gunshot wound to the leg. And when they really had a chance to look at it, the trajectory of that bullet actually had gone right up through his diaphragm and into his abdomen. So would you agree that the trajectory, should you know it or try to find out about it, is a factor?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of stories of bullets that end up in, you know, places we never expected. And that can be anything from the direct trajectory of the bullet when it struck the person to the bullet striking a bone and, you know, ricocheting into a different direction. So it's, I think we have to be very careful when we're looking, especially at potential proximal extremity wounds, that it is, it's not at all difficult for those projectiles to move into the thoracic or abdominal cavity and, you know, traverse some pretty significant areas. I mean, if you look at the groin or the axilla, you got lots of major neurovascular structures in there that bleed a lot and obviously can get you in trouble very quickly.
I can imagine. What's really fascinating to me is head injuries, because sometimes you have a bullet, someone tries to commit suicide, shoots themselves in the temple, and it goes around the skull and comes out the other side with no significant damage. You know, it just amazes me that people will have what appears to be a serious gunshot wound injury and they walk out of the ER. So that might be worthy of discussion.
Yeah, those are, you know, certainly a source of lots of stories. I think that they're not terribly common. And, you know, again, trajectory makes all the difference. You know, you can shoot yourself in the temple, but if the gun is aiming, you know, upward a lot, it's certainly not uncommon to have the bullet ricochet off the skull and then may ricochet off the the skin of the scalp on the inside and, you know, exit somewhere else without actually ever deeply penetrating the skull or resulting in significant intracranial injury. But I think those are relatively uncommon. And I think the assessment of the patient in those situations is obviously going to be around neuro status and airway status. And, you know, we're going to scan all of those people and assess their intracranial status to know where that bullet went and is at the time of evaluation.
In an extremity injury, which generally aren't life-threatening, but in terms of permanent injury, I assume that, vessels being involved, if you have a really bone injury that's real serious, nerves, of course, what are the types of things that can really cause some permanent injury from that point on?
Well, I think a lot of that just can be related to, you know, obviously transecting a nerve or a major vessel. Those kind of injuries are going to be pretty devastating to your functionality in that limb. Even if you don't directly sever a nerve, the pressure wave that flows through, you know, around the track of the bullet can result in lots of hematoma and bruising and all kinds of stuff to the nerve. So it's not uncommon to have some nerve damage related to that. How permanent that is obviously depends on the level of damage to the nerve. But, you know, I think we have to take even extremity wounds pretty seriously, especially related to gunshots, just because the potential is there to nick a small vessel and have some bleeding going on and then ultimately result in a compartment syndrome or something along those lines later on. It just takes some period of time for that to declare itself.
Jamie, you have a question?
I did. It's just a question and a statement, but it's something, as we think about all of these active shooter incidents that have happened, to my understanding, and maybe Joe can address this a little bit, but to my understanding, the one of the reasons for the high death toll, in addition to just the number of bullets fired in a short period of time, related more or to some extent to the fact that it was a rifle, that the velocity of the bullet has more to do with the damage it causes than the caliber of a bullet related to a handgun versus a long gun.
I think you touch on some really important stuff in there. The mathematical formula for energy is mass times velocity squared. So in general, the velocity has a much larger impact on the amount of energy that the bullet carries than the mass of the bullet. Rifles tend to be a more massive bullet, but also, generally moving at a much greater velocity. So assault weapons particularly are fairly high velocity weapons, and they use, bullets that are larger generally than handgun bullets, but they certainly are traveling at a much greater speed. So that imparts a lot more energy. And, I think the other thing that's important to talk about in active shooter response is sort of this concept of several years ago when we first began to really, unfortunately, see these events occur fairly commonly. We spent a lot of time putting together, hemorrhage control kits with tourniquets and things along those lines with the effort to stop the bleed, quote unquote. And I think if you look statistically at some of the more recent active shooter events. I don't know that I can, I haven't seen detailed information yet from El Paso and Dayton and some of those, but going back a little further than that, what we are seeing in many of these things now, especially those that utilize rifles or assault rifles, that sort of stuff, is that there are many more wounds that are in the core of the body, either the head, the chest, or the abdomen. Those are obviously much less amenable to use of a tourniquet or application of pressure, et cetera. It's much harder for us to treat those, especially in a way that meaningfully slows the hemorrhage. And, you know, if you go back as far as the Pulse nightclub and some of that sort of stuff and look at the injury patterns around that, what you saw was a large number of victims with multiple gunshot wounds, you know, three or four shots in the chest and abdomen or head, as opposed to, you know, a single wound in an extremity. The point of all this being that the weapons used and the injury patterns that we're currently seeing are actually making it much more challenging for first responders to be able to treat those patients and significantly impact survival, just because we're just simply limited on what we can do. We have less time to do it than we used to. And, you know, I can't put a tourniquet on your chest and have anything meaningful happen. So it presents new challenges, I think, for the responders out there and how we're going to deal with this new and emerging pattern of injuries that we're seeing in folks that have been victimized by these active shooter incidents.
But one good thing is many more police and other first responder level people are not only just taught about stop the bleed, but have the equipment to do it and aren't afraid to do it. So that's a good thing. But lastly, Joe, tell us what a Paragon active shooter training is like and what are some of the main lessons you want to impart?
Well, I think we've talked about a few of those. Usually what we'll do is spend a little bit of time just making certain that people are appreciating how the patterns are changing, much to the point that we just discussed, because you need to understand that in order to properly prepare. We make certain that folks have training in the important skills of airway management and hemorrhage control and, you know, chest decompression and all of those things that are absolutely essential, emergent, truly emergent, life-saving interventions. And then sort of expand from there to make certain that people understand the importance of being safe, how these events appear to frequently play out, things to look for, how to take care of themselves, sort of what they should and shouldn't do, and especially when it comes to professional responders, how to get law enforcement and fire and EMS and others sort of all on the same page in regard to not only the need to rapidly stop the shooter, but to rapidly respond to the victims of that shooter, because we have a very narrow time window in which to do that.
Amen.
Joe, so, you know, when people are hearing about these things and you know, hearing you describe the breadth of things that you cover in one of your active shooter training sessions, where, you know, seeing these events happen in places like a Walmart or in a city, open city street escape that has multiple restaurants and things where people are hanging out in the evening and nightclubs and such. There are a lot of communities that have places like that. So there are a lot of communities who probably need this kind of training. How can they reach out to you to find out what it would take to bring this specialized type of course to their responders?
Well, I think what we're learning is that absolutely no community is immune to these incidents, and that's a sad thing to say, but the fact, including a small community just south of Memphis just a month ago. But folks that are interested in talking to us and kind of talking about how we can customize a program that particularly works for their law enforcement, EMS, nursing, whoever. We would definitely love to talk to those folks, and we would ask them to reach out to us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com on the web or Paragon Medical Group on Facebook. They can reach us through the Disaster Podcast. And we're always happy to talk with them. We have our phone number and that sort of stuff on the webpage, and we'll look forward to hearing from folks.
Yeah, and it's important to say that this can be customized to whatever scenario they would find most beneficial to their community, whether it might be an outdoor event because they hold a regular fair every year they want to be prepared for, or something more, I hate to say conventional because that's just a horrible thing to even consider, but, like a Walmart situation that happened in El Paso. That's one of the things I think that you all bring to the table that is unique, is the ability to make this applicable to the people you're training. And I think that makes it super valuable.
Well, thanks, Jamie. We believe very strongly in that. It's got to work for the local community, and every community is a little different. And we work very hard to make certain we have the right people there that understand the situation, and that we involve the right folks to get the outcome that the community needs.
Well, thank you as always for your continued support and helping us bring the Disaster Podcast, including these clinical discussions, to the community of listeners that check out the show every week. Kyle, where can folks track you down when you're out and about and sharing what you're doing with the world?
Absolutely, Jamie. Folks can find me on all the social media places under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to follow me on Twitter and Instagram, or connect with me on LinkedIn to continue the conversation.
Awesome. And thanks again for bringing us the weather events and sharing your knowledge and expertise with the community. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly in our Facebook group, which is ever growing, and we get a lot of good discussions going on there, and a lot of good ideas and a lot of good guests, and the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
I'm available under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations, so friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And always here at the Disaster Podcast, whether you find us over at disasterpodcast.com or over at our Disaster Podcast Facebook group, still actively growing, a lot of good discussions and comments going on over there. So join us in that community by searching for Disaster Podcast on Facebook. We'd love to have you in. We'll certainly, after you request an invite, we'll bring you into the community. And you can participate. This is a great place where you can pose questions, post articles, reach out and tag specific members of our guest community that have been on shows in the past and ask for them to share their expertise. Maybe you have an event going on in your community and you've heard somebody talk about something similar on the show. Well, you can get on the Facebook group for the podcast and actually have a conversation with people that have done it before you and get a sense of what you're facing and what might help you smooth the way. That's all what part of the community is there for. And so we hope you'll continue to find us there. Sam, thanks for coming up with this idea for this particular episode. We haven't done a clinically based episode in a while, and it's something that we always try to kind of come back to from time to time. Even topics that we've discussed in the past. I know we've talked gunshot wounds in past episodes, but that's years ago in some cases for some of these topics, and it's always good to bring it back around and refresh people's knowledge so that they can continue to think about these things as on an ongoing basis.